Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
It had only done the stuff in the Atlantic, the Battle of the Atlantic protecting the convoys, then it would be worthy of note. You know, it achieved a phenomenal amount, but on the other hand, let's not pretend that with an aircraft with higher performance, it would have achieved more against the Regia Marina in the Mediterranean. Its poor performance was a factor in limiting its abilities in some cases.
Hello and welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Few aircraft encompass as many contradictions as the fairy swordfish, of course the legendary string bag. And it was approaching antiquation at the start of the Second World War, yet it struck mortal blows against some of the most powerful battleships in the Axis fleets. I'm joined by naval air historian Matt Willis, who has just authored the Fleet Air Arm Legends series all about the good old stringback. Matt, welcome back to Extended.
Well, hi, Peter. Delighted to be back.
Matt, I make this the 8th appearance on the show, an aircraft, of course, I thought I knew reasonably well, but it appears I didn't. And it appears particularly I didn't understand a lot of the operations that the swordfish was involved in and some of its characteristics. So let's go back to the beginning. I talked about potentially antiquated before the war even started. Let's talk about where it came from, the inception and development of the swordfish. Was it really developed too late?
Well, I mean, when you consider that the genesis of the swordfish was back in 1930 and even arguably really back to 1928 with a slightly earlier specification that wasn't carried through in the end, but was replaced with something later. And it came into service in 1936, which is a reasonably long development for an aircraft of the time. But this is fairly typical of interwar naval aircraft, that they tend to take a couple of years longer than their land-based equivalents to get them from the first sort of issue of a specification into actual squadron service, you know, for whatever reason. And there isn't a great sense of urgency about this in the interwar period, as you'd expect, really. Certainly up to the sort of mid-1930s, there's no real sense of urgency to be bringing in big advances in performance in carrier-based torpedo aircraft. You know, so we've had these sort of modest advances from aircraft like the Blackburn Dart that was replaced by the Ripon, and which was then replaced by a slightly improved version of the Baffin, and then it was after that the Swordfish came along, which again would have been expected to be a sort of modest improvement that would be in service for sort of, you know, 2 or 3 years, let's say, and then something slightly better would come along. But the problem you've got in the 1930s is big advances in aeronautical technology, big advances in aircraft performance. You're starting to see the introduction of monoplanes outstripping biplanes and stress skin airframe technology that leads to sort of much better performance. You know, engines are being developed that are, you know, rapidly outstripping the previous generation in power. And the Swordfish kind of falls into this period of really rapid development. And it's already a little bit behind because of the nature of it. And yet, you know, and it's appearing at the same time as things like the Spitfire and Hurricane. And yet it's a fabric covered biplane with open cockpits and fixed undercarriage, and you know, that's So yeah, was it developed? Was it developed too late? I mean, it was developed in the way that naval aircraft typically were for the Royal Navy between the wars. But I think part of the issue with the Swordfish was the aircraft that were meant to follow it, and that normally you'd expect that within, you know, by say 1940, that it would be really during its replacement, and something else would be taking over, and it wouldn't have really been such an issue.
Yeah.
So I think it's not such a case of was it developed too late. It was, why wasn't it followed in the normal way by something better, quite in the way that you would normally expect.
Yeah. And how did the Greeks get involved? I thought that was fascinating.
The poor old Greek Navy, who were really the sort of the people who kickstarted this aircraft, and who never got a sniff of it in the end. But they were looking for a torpedo bomber, I think probably to replace the Hawker Horsley, which was a sort of, you know, mid-90s. And they wanted a sort of general purpose aircraft, because, you know, it's a small naval air service. Yeah. They're not going to have a lot of airframes. They want to get sort of maximum use out of each one. So they're interested in a sort of general purpose aircraft that can do reconnaissance, bit of bombing, bit of torpedo attack. And they don't need to, you know, they don't need aircraft, they don't have aircraft carriers. So it's just sort of entirely land based. But, you know, this sort of maritime patrol and just general do everything aircraft. And Fairey start developing this aircraft for the Greek Navy, and it's related to an aircraft that they're developing for the Royal Navy at the time, but the one for the Royal Navy is a lot more specific. It's a spotter reconnaissance type, but also it's kind of bogged down with all of these typical sort of Royal Navy like equipment and capability requirements are the kind of things that sort of, you know, that perpetually bug naval aircraft. And these all these little things that make it more complicated, more expensive, and not necessarily that much better at its job. So we have a situation where when the Royal Navy is struggling a little bit to get its new aircraft, and they're going through this process of setting out a specification, getting responses from industry, not being terribly pleased with the responses from industry they get. Things take a little bit of a long time. So what they tend to end up doing is cancelling the specification and replacing it with a new one. And then kind of this process continues. And in the middle of that, Fairey comes to them with this sort of general, very practical, do everything biplane that actually looks like it might be better than the things that they've specifically asked for. So the Royal Navy says, kind of, okay, let's take a look, build us a prototype, and we'll see how we go.
Now, the first prototype. Oh, sorry, let me come back just a bit into context, because we named a few aircraft there, but the naming of the Swordfish reminded me. I don't think we've ever covered why do the Navy name their aircraft a particular way. So after fish, for example, and I was quite interested to see, because I don't know what was going through my mind, but of course they're all named after fish. And what was the convention for naming aircraft at that time?
Yeah, well, the fleet air arm at this point, really from the sort of early to mid 30s, introduces this naming policy, which is that torpedo aircraft, bombers, have the names of predatory fish. So you have names like the Swordfish and the Shark, slightly later things like the Tarpon, trying to think if there are any others around at this point. And then the fighters have the names of predatory seabirds. So you have the Fulmer, Skua.
Yeah.
Rock is slightly different because that's a mythological bird, and the Martlet, which again is another kind of, it's a heraldic bird actually. But they're also the fighters are birds, and the torpedo aircraft are fish. And I don't know whether this comes from tinfish, or whether it's just like you know, someone just thought it would be a good idea. And it doesn't stick around for that long, but, you know, it's throughout the sort of mid-1930s into the early 40s, this policy is developed.
Yeah, okay. So thanks for that. We'll come back at some time to how they ended up with Gannett, but I think we should park that one for a moment.
Yeah, well, Gannett, of course, was the British name for the Hellcat, which got dropped by the time the aircraft actually came into service. But, you know, so for a while they had this policy of renaming the American types in line with their own naming policy. So you had the Martlet rather than the Wildcat. And the Tarpon in place of the Avenger, but obviously then interoperability and complication, and probably just the fact that the American names were just plain better. You know, they're kind of that much more inspiring. So, you know, decided, okay, let's stick to the American names.
Okay, sorry, I digressed there. The other thing I was quite interested to hear about was for the specification of the Swordfish, how important the Navy felt for it to be a float plane.
Again, I mean, this was quite at the time, most of their aircraft were also had to have this sort of convertible float undercarriage, and this had been something that sort of between the wars had been very important, and most of their aircraft had sort of dual purpose, both as carrier aircraft and as float planes. Part of this was because they like to use the same types, you know, from catapults on cruisers and battleships and things like that, and it helped to have that rather than to have a whole new specialist type just for that relatively minor use. But you know, even the fighters, the specifications included float undercarriage, so the Skua and Rock had. You know, had plans for a float undercarriage, and even the Fulma, although it never wore its floats, it was initially specified to have a float undercarriage.
Right. Okay. Just one other thing, just before we talk about it coming into service, what was the power plant and because the spec did shift a little bit. We talked about the Greek influence there, potentially simplifying some of the spec, but there were also, so after the loss of the first the prototype in an accident, they made a few changes, didn't they?
Yes, and in reality, I think that crash probably did the aircraft quite a lot of good, because it meant that they could redesign it, and this crash, we should talk about in the book, but the test pilot, Chris Stanland, was attempting to do some testing of the spinning characteristics, and was actually, the aircraft was so stable, he was struggling to get it to spin. And then when he did, the spin became very flat, and he couldn't recover from it and had to bail out, and the prototype was lost. So this could have been a serious blow. There was a possibility that, you know, usually when this happens, when you lose a single prototype and that's all you've got during the program, quite often that leads to the end of the program, because that's it. You know, you've got, it would take however long to build another prototype. You've lost all that time. Progress marches on. They, you know, usually just say, fine, scrap it, and, you know, we'll go on with something else. But in this case, I think Fairey was very, it believed in very much in the aircraft. It put a very high priority on it, redesigned the aircraft. So with a longer rear fuselage, bigger fin and rudder, slightly more sweep back on the wings, a little bit more wing area, and some of the sort of characteristic Swordfish shapes start to appear at this stage. You know, this helps make the aircraft, because it's always had this reputation for being kind of incredibly easy to fly, very sort of confidence inspiring in the pilots, very, you know, stable but maneuverable. You know, it's either of those things when you need it to be. And I think that partly came out of this redesign from when the first aircraft crashed. So they really were able to fine tune it to quite a good degree. So, you know, its strengths remained, and it's they eliminated its weaknesses. So it was a very well sorted aeroplane in most respects, really, from the beginning. And the power plant you mentioned, that it started off with an Armstrong Siddeley Panther for the Greek Navy. This was changed quite soon for a Bristol Pegasus, which, you know, the immortal Bristol Pegasus, which was, the aircraft that the engine that powered every single Swordfish, and just developed this reputation for being an incredibly reliable and dependable engine that was, really well suited to working on carrier conditions. It was nice and simple. It was very well established sort of Bristol technology by this time, and but it was advanced enough to do the job. It was quite, it wasn't on the absolute cutting edge even when it came out, really, but it was never intended as a sort of high performance engine. It was designed for aircraft like the Swordfish, which were, so, you know, it would have good power, but, you know, reliable, and it complemented the aircraft. It was pretty bulletproof, and it provided good power within its sort of parameters, really. So it was just, whereas the Blackburn Shark got the Armstrong Siddeley Armstrong Siddeley Tiger, which had all kinds of problems. It was the Tiger that killed off the Shark, really. Whereas the Swordfish got the Pegasus, and that was it. I think it could have been less lucky with its engine, but it was partly the fact that it had this fantastic engine that really helped it secure its place in the fleet area.
I was just going to say, and as a result of some of those changes to the spec and the reliability of the power plant, the Navy placed its orders. But as you were hinting at earlier, it really was a stepping stone to the Albacore, in effect. It was only meant to be there for 2 to 3 years. But as we know, as we'll get on to, as it entered service, the war started, and of course things really took over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if the timing of this, I found was very interesting, really, and quite critical to the nature of the aircraft. And I think there are a lot of assumptions about the Swordfish. There's often said about it that it outlived its replacement in service, and so the Albacore came along, but the Swordfish was still going on, and the Swordfish was in service for longer than the Albacore was. And there seems to be a general assumption from this viewpoint that was because the Swordfish was better than the Albacore, and that the Albacore was inferior, and it faded away, and the Swordfish kept going. And that was true, of course, but actually for very practical reasons that had nothing to do with the performance or the capability of either aircraft. And so you had this situation where, coming up to the outbreak of war, in the summer of 1940, Swordfish production was tailing away, and the notion was that it would be replaced. It would be replaced in production by the Albacore. I think the last Swordfish were supposed to be delivered around, I think, by September 1940, which to 1939, sorry, which is the month that war broke out. But what was happening was what always happens when you replace one aircraft on a production line with another type, which is that production of the old type tails away and production of the new type builds up, and you have a gap in the middle where you're not receiving very many aeroplanes. And this is absolutely the last thing that the service needed, just as they were going into a war when they were expecting to have very heavy casualties. And there was a question of what to do about this. So the the natural thing was to set up another production line, and Blackburn, who were, you know, experienced builders of torpedo aircraft for the Fleet Air Arm, were approached to see if they would license build. At the time, the suggestion was, quite naturally, that it would be the Albacore that they would license build, because it's the new type, it's the type that's coming in, it's going to replace the Swordfish, they want to bring a second supply of that on stream so that they will get enough aircraft. But because you've got this critical juncture, really, from September 1939 through to however long you can really set up another production line. So I think it won't be until something like July 1940 that decent numbers of Albacores are going to be coming through from Fairey. And it'll take however much longer to set up another production line for Blackburn. So you've got a dangerous period of potentially over a year when you're not getting that many new aircraft through, and you might not, and the Fleet Air Arm just might not be able to replace losses. So the suggestion was made that actually the second production line, the new production line, could build Swordfish. And there were numerous advantages to this, because when Fairey tailed away its production of Swordfish, it could then supply all the tooling and jigs and so on that it didn't need. Some of them it would be able to reuse for other aircraft, but most of them it could ship straight to Blackburn to set up in the new factory, and that would enable Blackburn to actually get aircraft into production. I think the estimate was 4 months earlier than if they were building a new type. And at the same time, the Fairey Barracuda, which we've spoken about before, that was also meant to be in train. And that was meant to be, I think at the time, the estimate was that deliveries of that would start probably in around March 1941. So the natural thing to do was to say, well, what's going to give us the maximum number of airframes as soon as possible? And the answer to that was put the Swordfish into production over at Blackburn, and take the Albacore production from Fairey, and just supplement the Albacore with the Swordfish for as long as you need to, and then by mid 1941 we'll be starting to get the Barracuda, a properly modern aircraft, into service anyway. So we can plug that gap, and even though it's an older aircraft, it's not as good. And, you know, they were quite, the Admiralty, the Fleet Air Arm, were quite sort of open about the fact that the Albacore had, you know, quite a significantly better performance than the Swordfish in some respects. It was about 20 miles an hour faster. It had almost double the range, had slightly greater load carrying ability, and then it had the benefits of an enclosed cockpit, you know, which for sort of crew comfort and efficiency was actually quite important. And you know, so it was favored, but there was just this complication over production, in order to get enough airframes that were good enough, that, you know, that would just about do the job, it was a case of they needed to put that second production line into place. And actually Blackburn ended up building more Swordfish than Fairey had, and because that production line was there and it was just churning out aircraft and they could continue to find use for this aircraft, actually that kept running then for more or less the rest of, well, until, you know, until 1944. So halfway through 1944, they were still building this, you know, kind of mid-interwar period biplane that was, you know, just an antique by this point. But, you know, it was, and that's and that's why the Swordfish kept going, and why it ended up supplanting the Albacore in some respects, and outliving it, not in the intended role that they'd been developed for, but in all these other additional roles that were created for it, and that it was found that it was suitable for. So so I think that's one of those kind of quirks of logistics and supply issues and things that end up affecting things on the front line, but that aspect of it isn't particularly appreciated. I think people always kind of assume that you put the best air, you know, you've got the choice of aircraft and you put the best one into service where it's needed. But actually, you know, there's so much of a tail on these things. There's so much of a sort of long lead-in times for all of these production issues that you know what you're going to war with is the result of decisions that were made months or years ago.
I was fascinated by that, and it's not one of those myths, but that point about it outlasted the aircraft that follow it just wasn't true, really. It was true only on the basis of the way you've just explained it, and it makes so much more sense.
Did you know that the first G suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
But let's start talking about how she came into operation. And quite interestingly, the way that you tackled it in the book is almost like a theatre type, you know, where it operated in the various theatres rather than a chronological, you know, 39 to 45 type approach, which I thought was really interesting. And the reason I think that's interesting is what it allowed you to do is debunk some of the things like Taranto and some of the and the Bismarck and things like that, where there is a view about the Swordfish's role, and there's one view and one view only that's come through decades of history that is not untrue, but you haven't got all the facts. So let's talk about some of those theatres and where it operated. Matt, what's the best one to pick first? Where should we go first with it? I've got a particular fascination with the warmer climes, but they tended to come later.
I'm going to say Norway, because again, I think this is one of those.
Okay,
don't need to say a great deal about Norway, but I think this is one of those ones that tends to get a little bit neglected and sort of pushed to one side slightly, partly because the Swordfish didn't have conspicuous success there, but actually, I think there's some really interesting stuff that went on during Norway that sort of helped sort of shape the career that the aircraft had, and it helped develop the sort of knowledge that was needed to actually have some of those successes later on. And I think, you know, the naval battles of Narvik, which are sort of, you know, quite famous in some respects, a sort of naval surface ship engagements. Actually, the Swordfish did get involved in those and was sort of making some sort of low level bombing attacks in horrendous weather, that was sort of not actually having a great deal of practical success, but they were contributing to this sort of pummeling that the German destroyers were getting in Narvik. And of course, there's also the situation of the submarine that was sunk by the Swordfish float plane that was there to provide reconnaissance and gunnery spotting, and happened to see this submarine and was carrying anti-submarine bombs, which were sort of early aircraft mounted depth charges that weren't very successful. But on this occasion, it's believed that one of the bombs might have fallen through the forward hatch of the submarine, which is sort of a chance in a million, but it would explain why it hit from one of these really quite, you know, they're only 100-pound bombs. Actually, sort of, you know, sunk the submarine there and then. It just, you know, just sort of blew the bottom out of it, and it started going down immediately. So, we're in the middle of this naval battle between surface ships, so it's sort of quite a remarkable interlude, really. And then the Swordfish went back to providing location reports for the German destroyers and spotting for the fall of shot. So, you know, some of the stuff, some of the weather they were dealing with sort of start, it sort of really helped cement this sense of the Swordfish as an aircraft that could operate in pretty much any weather conditions, and you know, from a heaving deck and in, you know, in ice and snow and all kinds of stuff like that. And I think it sort of helped build the confidence of the crews that it would do what they asked of it, which I think was always a big strength of the Swordfish, more so than.
And the number of. A whole number of operations up in Norway as well. I was really surprised because, again, from what I know and from what I've heard and from what I've always been taught, it seems a very sporadic use of the aircraft. But it wasn't like that, was it? There were multiple operations, not only against ships, but against land-based targets as well. I was genuinely surprised by the amount of ops they were undertaking.
Yeah, absolutely. So there were a couple of attacks on a German held airfield, which destroyed aircraft on the ground and hangars and so on. Which was I don't think there were many fighters up in that theatre at that time, which was probably why they were able to get away with some of these operations that they really couldn't have done a bit later on. But they earned their keep. Even though they weren't in their, the role they'd really been designed for was kind of fleet reconnaissance and torpedo attack on an enemy battle fleet, which is the kind of stuff they would be doing a bit of in the Mediterranean later on. But it was really quite different. I mean, David Hobbs, has written a lot about the fleet air arm in the Second World War, has kind of portrayed this the Norwegian operations as the birth of the strike carrier. And the sort of the sense of the modern strike carrier that we're very familiar with nowadays was pioneered in the Norwegian campaign when these operations were taking place sort of inshore and against land-based targets or against sort of inshore shipping and those sorts of things, and rather than being kind of out in blue water operations. Ships kind of hundreds of miles from shore-based aircraft.
And were we also seeing that the aircraft, how the aircraft was used, how the crews were skilled, was developing really up in that North Sea theatre that, as you say, came to great benefit later in the war, when they really knew how to use the platform, how to train the crews to torpedo as well.
Yeah, definitely. And particularly there were these, the beginnings of the sort of the torpedo attacks against ships in port or in shallow inshore waters, which wasn't really in the thinking when the aircraft was developed and when the tactics were developed. So they were really developing the ideas for this at the time and realizing the benefits of it. So there were a couple of attacks of against warships that were kind of secreted away in fjords and not having a lot of success, but each time learning something new about things like depth setting on the torpedoes and where to approach from and how to divide up a flight to provide to divide defences and things like that, and all of these sorts of lessons, which would be put into really good use in the Mediterranean, started to be developed in Norway. I think that's probably fairly underappreciated, some of the work that they were doing then. It's fair to say that some of the operations, they just didn't come off at all. And then the importance of reconnaissance.
Yeah.
Because, they were doing things like they were getting a report of a cruiser and half a dozen destroyers in a fjord, and they would turn up and there'd be nothing there because the reports were out of date and because they hadn't been keeping up with the reconnaissance. And obviously the reconnaissance was a major feature at Taranto that kind of planning that could be achieved from real-time reconnaissance and real-time intelligence. It was in Norway where they started to realize the nature of keeping up with these very kind of mobile situations. So yeah, so they were doing the reconnaissance, they were doing all the anti-submarine work, and this is the other thing with the Swordfish, is that it always has to be doing the anti-submarine patrol. Whatever else it's got on, it's always got to keep up with this anti-submarine work, which is kind of really unglamorous, but really crucial. Particularly when you've got some of these small carriers that don't have, you know, Royal Navy carriers never have that much capacity for aircraft, certainly not compared with US Navy ones. So you have these sort of small numbers of aircraft that have got to do all these roles and try and be effective at the same time. And again, going into the Mediterranean, which I'm sure we'll talk a bit about, this really becomes quite a sort of noticeable feature of the operations there is how much they have to wring out of every aircraft.
The Battle of the Atlantic as well, and in the Atlantic, that role was absolutely crucial. And again, the work we did on the Coastal Command series, I didn't really understand how involved the Swordfish was in a lot of that, in that boring of anti-submarine watching. And there's some great quotes that you've got in the book about, the days were dull, they were boring, but they knew, because if they were dull and boring, they were almost certainly likely not to have U-boats in the area, because the U-boats knew, they could see them, they could hear them. And if they knew they were around, it was time to move on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the Swordfish's career is really divided into these two significant areas, the first of which is as a fleet torpedo bomber, which was designed, which would be to work with the big fleet carriers, to work with the Royal Navy battle fleet as a weapon against enemy battle fleets, and which it did in the case of lots of the clashes in the Mediterranean, and also against the Bismarck, and to a slightly lesser extent against some of the other sort of Kriegsmarine warships. And the other big career was at the convoy protection on the Woolworth carriers. From 1942 onwards, this career of convoy protection in the Atlantic, in the Arctic, and down to the Gibraltar convoys as well, to an extent. Again, that was a little bit later in the war. So I think that's the big dividing line between the Swordfish's career. But it was always doing this anti-submarine work in addition to all of the kind of glamorous stuff against battleships. So you always had to have a couple of aircraft patrolling, fitted up with depth charges and looking out for the U-boats, because that you can't as they found out in the early days of the war, you cannot let the U-boats get a look in, or you'll be losing carriers. Within days of the opening of the war in an ill-fated attempt to hunt for submarines. Ark Royal very nearly got sunk in the same situation. So this was always a kind of crucial part of the Swordfish's sort of weaponry, really. It's armory.
Before we go on to the Med and Taranto, can we just quickly cover, I say quickly only because time is pressing, talk about the Channel Dash, because you do talk about it. And again, there is a particular narrative around the Channel Dash, and I wouldn't want to take away from anything I think that's well known about that incident, but you look at it in a slightly different way. You've brought some new areas of focus in, and it's not just we sent X number out and X came back or didn't. You go into some detail. Do you just want to tell us about some of the things you found and talk about in the role of the aircraft in that incident?
The trap with anything like the Channel Dash any of these operations with incredibly heavy losses and no benefit is to sort of regard them as you go down the Charge of the Light Brigade route, and you start romanticizing yeah. the, I don't want to use the word failure, but you know, that was what it was. And that had nothing to do with the Swordfish crews, the you have A25 squadron, or the commander Eugene Esmond, who had been decorated for his role in the attacks on the Bismarck. But I think the way I look at it is as something that should never have happened in the first place. And the Swordfish were meant as kind of a relatively minor part of the operation against the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, and the efforts to break them from the Atlantic through to Norway in the early part of 1942. There was a large operation which involved a large chunk of the Royal Navy and the RAF that were intended to stop this happening and to knock these very dangerous warships out of the war, if at all possible. And the Swordfish were there. You know, there were half a squadron, half of 825 squadron, which was rebuilding after having reformed, their role in it was intended to be only if the Kriegsmarine vessels task force attempted to break through that part of the channel during the night. And now it was appreciated by this time that the Swordfish was becoming less and less viable as an attack platform during the daytime. Certainly when there was a possibility of enemy fighters in the vicinity, just because its performance was so low by modern standards. Its armament was so light, it couldn't survive against modern fighters. And I think there's an issue to which, this is true to a large extent of all carrier-based torpedo aircraft at the time, that without a very strong escort, they weren't really survivable in the presence of enemy fighters. And you saw this at Midway and places like that with much more modern aircraft than the Swordfish. But anyway, so that's just to sort of add some context to it. But they were developing in order to circumvent this and to sort of play to the Swordfish's strengths, they were building up a capability of night attack. And this had been used in the Mediterranean and in other places to quite good effect. And it was used, Swordfish based from Malta, attacking convoys during the night. The attack on Taranto took place during the night, and various of the attacks on Italian ships in harbour, Tobruk and Augusta, also took place at night. And this was because the Swordfish was capable of operating at night, and because new technologies such as ASV radar were feeding through, were starting to become, from sort of early 1941, they were starting to become available, and this really was adding new dimensions to the Swordfish. It was helpfully extending the Swordfish's career, because I think without radar, it would have really become fully obsolete a lot earlier than it did. But the addition of radar meant that it could operate in these conditions where it wouldn't have to face enemy fighters, and where it didn't need the visibility, so it could operate in bad weather and in darkness. The role which the Swordfish of 85 Squadron were intended to provide in the defence against Operation Cerberus, which is the breakthrough of the German warships back to Norway, was meant to be in the event of a night passage, and to provide a capability that was otherwise unavailable that would allow an attack to be made on the ships at night. Now, as we know, they didn't choose to do that. They ended up leaving at night, leaving Brest at night, which meant that they could be gone by the time the Allied intelligence realised they were gone, which threw the British onto the back foot during the whole operation, really. And then, because of various failures and issues that arose with the RAF aircraft and the weather conditions and the visibility and the communications, the RAF hadn't managed to stage an attack at this point. At the point when the ships were kind of reaching the narrows of the channel, and were really kind of moving through into the North Sea by about, I think, midday on the sort of second day of the operation. And it got to the point where the only aircraft that could potentially reach them to stage an attack before they fully broke through into the North Sea were these sort of half a dozen Swordfish of 825 Squadron based at Manston. And so they sent them off, and there was a very real question even at the time as to whether they should go. And the admiral in charge of the naval operations, Admiral Ramsay, and Eugene Esmond in command of 825 Squadron were pretty clear that they would need an extremely strong fighter escort if they were going to have any chance of getting through. And this kind of then broke into sort of some cultural differences between the Navy and the RAF, where the Navy would tend to sort of press on and make an attack even if the situation wasn't perfect. When Dudley Pound, who was in overall charge of the Navy, when this was put to him, he said something to the effect of the Royal Navy will meet the enemy wherever and whenever he is to be engaged. So Admiral Pound's comments were sending the men of 825 Squadron to their deaths, as far as I'm concerned. There were plenty of arguments as to why they should be sent, you know, because essentially they were the only aircraft able to engage those ships at that particular time. It was worth a throw of the dice. I mean, I think it was a very, very speculative throw of the dice, and certainly with, you know, the RAF, we in the end were able to provide, I think it was 10 Spitfires for escort, which everyone at the time recognised wasn't nearly enough. The other squadrons, I think it had been appreciated that they would be unable to carry out the briefing and preparations and get into the air in the time necessary, so they just stood down. They didn't even attempt to make the rendezvous. And I think, to be honest, it probably wouldn't have made any difference if they had, because if they were going to be too late. And the issue that Esmond had with the Swordfish was, because of their low performance, every extra minute that the ships were passing Dover, passing Manston, and heading off out into the North Sea was an additional minute that they would be subjected to the very strong fighter escort that the Luftwaffe was providing, the fighter umbrella over the ships. So it was imperative that they got going fairly quickly, otherwise they'd have just been cut down before they got anywhere near the enemy ships. And as it was, you know, they set off were cut to pieces really within, you know, they were attacked within a couple of minutes of leaving Manston. They got within sight of the enemy warships. A couple of them managed to launch their torpedo at extreme range. You know, no one really knows what happened to those torpedoes. They didn't really go anywhere near any of the warships, unfortunately. And three of the aircraft, just no one knows what happened to them. They were last seen heading off towards this absolute storm of defences and just never seen again. It was a really stark reminder of the the shortcomings of the Swordfish in conditions that it wasn't intended for.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Let's leave Northern Europe there and then start heading south. We've mentioned Taranto a few times there. And again, you know, the story's well told. And I know we've talked about it in the past, but I was fascinated to hear the wider strategic issues in the Mediterranean. You know, again, you mentioned Malta and strike operations by the Swordfish on Malta. But Taranto wasn't an isolated incident, was it? It was part of a much wider set of individual battles.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there was the situation in the Mediterranean was very much one of sort of balance of power, balance of naval power, which both sides were kind of struggling to maintain their own naval power and to try and erode the enemy's naval power. And this was a part of it was kind of a war of supply lines. So the Axis had their supply lines across the Mediterranean from north to south to supply their armies in North Africa and to try and the Allies out of the theatre there, and then perhaps open the way to the oil supplies of the Middle East and that kind of thing. Whereas for the Allies, it was the east-west convoy routes that were important because the Allies controlled the entrance to the Mediterranean at both ends. They controlled the Straits of Gibraltar and they controlled the Suez Canal. So obviously those were very important pinch points for the Axis. But the Axis had, you know, Italy sort of sticking down into the middle of the Mediterranean and dividing it into two and making it very difficult for the Allies to operate all the way through the Mediterranean. So there was a sort of strategic picture. And, you know, there were constantly really convoys moving about and the naval forces were usually attempting to sort of defend their own convoys and attack the enemies. And that was sort of, that was partly what was going on with Taranto, was that there were some large convoys that were planned at the time and that it was not a diversionary attack. So as much as it was an attempt to try and keep down the Regia Marina while these convoys were going ahead and to sort of keep their heads down. But it was an opportunity to strike a really strategic blow against the Italian Navy and do real kind of material damage to the battle fleet in its safe harbour in Taranto. This was really kind of a one-shot deal because the Italians were building up their defences at the harbour. In a fairly short period of time, they'd have a lot more coverage of torpedo nets, a lot more coverage of barrage balloons, and it would be a lot more difficult to put on an aerial attack. At the same time, the fleet air arm had only really gained certain capabilities recently, so they'd only just got hold of, in theatre, long-range fuel tanks for the Swordfish, which would enable the Swordfish to be launched at a sufficiently safe range to otherwise, I think it would have put the Navy, the Royal Navy fleet at very significant risk.
At risk,
So that was an important part. There was also the aerial reconnaissance that I mentioned earlier, that now the value of that, after those earlier operations, the value of it was really recognised, and the notion, the understanding was that you couldn't put on an operation like this unless you had very, very good intelligence on the state of the defences and the location of individual warships if possible and things like that. So the RAF on Malta had recently obtained some Martin Maryland light bombers, which being much faster than the flying boats that they had, were able to sort of dash in and get good photographs of the defences at Taranto and dash out again. So that was an important part. Without that, I think it would have been very difficult for them to put on a successful operation. So those factors were important. So it was kind of a very narrow window of opportunity that the Navy had to try and make this attack. You know, and it was, I think, by any standards, phenomenally successful. You know, they lost two Swordfish, one crew, one taken prisoner. The others were killed. And for that, they put out of action three three Italian battleships for a period of time. You know, one of the newest one, Littorio, which was a really, really powerful ship, and it was probably about the most powerful ship in theatre at the time. And, you know, really modern, fast, heavily armed battleship, which was kind of a big part of the...
I think it's fair. It's fair to say, Matt, on that point, I think a lot of people, again, with hindsight, look through particularly tinted glasses. The Italian fleet was really strong, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I believe it was. You know, I mean, they had, at this point, two brand-new warship battleships, which were some of the best in the world. They had four rebuilt, you know, heavily modernized First World War battleships, which I think were... you know, were the equal of most of the older battleships. You know, I think they were more than equal to the older battleships, the older Royal Navy battleships in theatre, and, you know, arguably as good in some respects as some of the modernised Royal Navy battleships. They were more, you know, and they were extremely fast. You know, for such old ships, you know, they were, very, very fast, which kind of... You know, when you've got faster ships, you can
dictate
the terms of combat, really, which was something that they used to some quite good effect, is that you know, you can engage and disengage at will. So, you know, and it knocked these three warships out of action. The Littorio, which took three torpedo hits, I think was back in service within about 4 months. And the Duilio, which was one of the newer modernized battleships, was put out of action for I think it was sort of 6 to 8 months. So, you know, it did affect the balance of power. It wasn't the decisive blow that it's often been characterized as. And the Regia Marina was still able to function. They still came out of this notion that the Italian Navy stayed in port for the rest of the war is completely wrong. And, you know, they were in operation again really quite soon after that, and actually, you know, having a material effect on, you know, a detrimental effect on Royal Navy operations. You know, there was an attempt to supply Malta with Hurricanes, which went quite badly just because the Italian Navy was threatening. So, you know, it wasn't... It was a major blow. It was a setback to the Italian Navy. It assisted the Royal Navy in maintaining their kind of their naval strength and their ability to bring through convoys. It affected that for a period of time. But it was part of the ebb and flow of the war in the Mediterranean. It wasn't a single knockout blow. It wasn't a killer blow. You know, and the Italian Navy did come back. So but on the other hand, it was a major, major success. And for the effort and the cost, it was the outcome was quite remarkable.
Yeah.
And I think that you can always argue that they could have achieved more. Arguably, they could have equipped some more aircraft with torpedoes rather than sort of hedging their bets and fitting some aircraft with bombs to try and attack cruisers in the inner harbour. They could have thrown everything at trying to knock the battleships out, and they might have been able to take out one or two more. And again, this is in some of the sort of more recent scholarship. There's been a bit of a sort of, you know, revisionist look at Taranto, and you know, some people I think have potentially gone a bit far the other way and sort of said that really it didn't achieve much, and it could have achieved a lot more, and it was a big missed opportunity. And you know, I think there's validity on both sides of the argument, because I think whichever way you cut it, it was a phenomenal achievement of a handful of really quite out of date biplanes, and in a theatre in which it wasn't even clear that carriers could survive for very long, and certainly the Royal Navy's view on this was that there was only a limited time in which a carrier could exist in the Mediterranean without being knocked out, because of, you know, such were the restriction of the waters and the strength of the enemy's defences, and that the idea that they would be under vulnerable to air attack for a large part of the time, and that they wouldn't be able to survive more than a period of time, so they had to kind of get as much use out of them as they could. So in that context,
but what that did really, what it was doing there is reinforcing that point that you made earlier about a stable platform at night with radar gave the swordfish a niche that it really, really was able to exploit there. That airframe,
yeah, I mean, they
was probably right.
Sorry.
No, I was going to say the airframe was what was available. It was the best that was available at that job at night, and it went on to prove itself even further in the Mediterranean as a night attack aircraft. And Taranto was just one example of that, a very successful and a very notable one. But I think it proved the point. The Swordfish at night at that time was probably the best platform they had.
Yeah, absolutely. It was its ability to function at that time. And I think also, I mean, you mentioned radar. They didn't even have radar during the Taranto operation. That was entirely sort of navigation, sort of by old school means, and target acquisition by old school.
Even more commendable.
Probably relatively few aircraft at the time would have been capable of doing that. And then, you know, you also had things like the duplex pistol torpedo, which was this magnetic fuse torpedo, which it turned out worked quite well in attacks like the ones on Taranto, but actually worked a lot less well in open sea, which they found in the attack on the Bismarck. All the magnetic fuse torpedoes detonated early, they had to go back and fit the contact fuses, the old style torpedoes. But yeah, so there were, in terms of what was available and what they could do with it, and again, it's this thing that the Fleet Air Arm has always, I think, been very good at cutting its coat according to its cloth. And quite often in its history, it's found it's got less than ideal aircraft, but has been able to find ways to play to the strengths of those aircraft and the ships and the weapons available. So I think, you know, if you look, you know, going up to the Falklands and situations like that, I think that there is this ability that the Fleet Air Arm has to sort of pull unlikely successes out of equipment that on paper doesn't look good enough.
And it went on to, I mean, we can't cover it all. I mean, I've got probably 30, 40, 50 stories I want you to tell, and we can't do them all any justice. And more importantly, we want people to go out and read it. But I just want to pick out a few other things from the from MedOps, and that was, and I had to get my big aviation aeroplane encyclopedia out, that the Swordfish actually became an interceptor when it attacked the Seagull, the Kant 506. When I read that, I had to get my big book out and do a little research on it. But you know, the good old Swordfish took on this flying boat. I'll put a link to the aircraft so that people can see it. Harried it to death as an interceptor, and I thought that was an absolutely fascinating story. But also, I was surprised at its use in Sardinia, the Port Sudan attacks, the attacks on the French Vichy ships as well. So there's a massive amount in the book about the Swordfish's ops in the Med, which we don't have time to cover now. But one thing I wanted to do before we look to talk about looking back on the Swordfish is also I was incredibly surprised by seeing the Swordfish operating in the Indian Ocean on the plan to take Madagascar. And again, you know, carrier-based Swordfish flying off not only to attack ships, but also to bomb the ports and things like that. Absolutely fascinating, Matt. So I really do encourage people to go and get the book, if nothing else, to see the breadth of operations the Swordfish was involved in, because I genuinely had not heard of some of those ops. So really, really good read. But let's start to wrap up, because time is pressing on us. I want to see if we can just really break down how effective the Swordfish was. We know it wasn't what the Fleet Aeron probably needed when it was there, but as you quite rightly described it, it cut its cloth accordingly. Does it deserve the reputation that, you know, it should have been, it was obsolete, it wasn't what they wanted, it wasn't what they needed, and therefore wasn't necessarily a success?
I think what I would encourage is for people to be genuinely in awe of its successes while being realistic about its shortcomings. And you know, this actually, I mean, it's one of these aircraft that there's an immense amount of affection for it, you know, and quite rightly so. And air crews were broadly speaking very affectionate towards the Swordfish, and that's kind of carried through into the way kind of the public looks back on it. And yeah, it's, I think, the aircraft probably second only to the Spitfire that I've found, that some people will get really quite angry if you say anything negative about it. And you know, it's just like, I've got immense respect for the Swordfish, but you know, just as a basic good piece of sound piece of design, that even as aircraft performance massively outstripped it, was able to continue to do useful work just because it was a basically sound aeroplane. And you know, it did achieve an awful lot. You know, if it had only achieved Taranto, then it would be worthy of note. If it had only achieved, seriously damaging the Bismarck stern sufficiently to allow the battle fleet to catch up with it, it would be worthy of note. And if it had only done some of those things that actually aren't very well known, that I talk about in the book, such as those sort of the earlier, yeah, raids against ships in harbour in the Mediterranean, which I think we haven't had time to talk about, but I think those are really interesting in the way that they play into Taranto and some of those, yeah, other operations. You know, I think if it had only done that, then it would be worthy of note. And if it had only done the stuff in the Atlantic, the Battle of the Atlantic protecting the convoys, then it would be worthy of note. You know, it achieved a phenomenal amount, but on the other hand, let's not pretend that with an aircraft with higher performance, it would have achieved more against the Regia Marina in the Mediterranean. Its poor performance was a factor in limiting its abilities in some cases. You know, an aircraft with an enclosed cockpit would have made a big difference to a lot of crews in the North Atlantic and the Arctic. And, you know, by the end of the war, I think it was being proved that the aircraft like the Avenger were actually a lot more suitable even on the Woolworth carriers, that they were having a lot fewer undercarriage breakages on in landing accidents, that they were able to engage a lot more U-boats after sightings and that kind of thing. And I think the British had somewhat underestimated the benefits of a higher performance aircraft, and also had kind of, they thought that, you know, they had this biplane with a fixed undercarriage, and that, you know, it must be immensely strong. And I don't think they realized that, you know, the way Grumman was building aircraft undercarriages is that you could drop a couple of tons of aeroplane on it on a heaving deck, and it would just like sag down and then rise up again, and that would be would be fine.
And there's some, just on the Americans, actually, there's some really interesting, you've got some great quotes in the book about the Americans' views of the swordfish, which we won't talk about here. You have to buy the book to read. And they're not all derogatory either. But yeah, that was, I had a wry smile as I read that. So Matt, let's just sum up. There are a few other things I just wanted to bring out. Lots of original photos. Yeah. In the book, and as I sat there reading one of those book, I came across a photo of a swordfish that actually my father had flown twice. That was an amazing coincidence. Checked on his logbook, and he'd flown that aircraft twice. So we'll put a picture of that in with the show notes. Also the graphics. You've done your own graphics in the book as well, in particular to highlight some of the nuances about the schemes and the colouring and that sort of thing. So there's some great graphics in there, particularly like the weather-worn one, the blackfish as well. So there's some great graphics in there as well. But Matt, where can we find you and get a copy of the book online?
Before I sort of move on to that, I would just like to say as well, you know, I'm absolutely indebted to Brian Riley, who was an observer on swordfish in the from MAC ships in the Battle of the Atlantic, unfortunately, Brian's no longer with us, but and his family as well, who enabled me to do a number of interviews with Brian and get his experiences of that kind of really really important operations, and some of those kind of completely original recollections are in the book. So I just want to sort of shout out to Brian and Philip Riley and Fiona, who helped no end with this book, and I want to write more about Brian in time, but his swordfish experience, he was also in that out in the Pacific, but his swordfish experiences I've been able to cover a little bit of in this book, so I think that's sort of something that people won't be able to read about anywhere else. People can find me, I am on Twitter at Naval Air History. I have the blog navalairhistory.com, which is I have been very bad at updating recently, but you know there are a lot of articles on there about naval aviation and maritime aviation, and I'm going to try and be better this year at putting some new information on that site, but there's plenty there to get your teeth into if you're interested in that.
We'll put links to the book in the show notes as well. And I suppose the departing question, you've been particularly busy recently with some magazine type publications. Any interesting projects on the horizon book wise for you?
I'm currently working on a book for Morton's, the same publisher as the Swordfish book, on the Focke-Wulf 200 Condor, German maritime patrol bomber. A very interesting aircraft, bit of a departure for me to do German subject matter, so that should be out at some point this year. And other things, I have so many planned projects, it's just a case of trying to shuffle them all around and stick them together.
All right, Matt, I won't harass you too much on that. We'll look out for the Condor book, and again, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us a little bit more about an aircraft we probably all thought we knew a lot about, but actually until this came out we probably didn't. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Peter.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.